What I'd like to do today is a little bit of a mixture. I'd like to go on and talk about some navigator responses and needs, which, if you have your handout, will be on the reverse side. If you do not, I have some additional handouts here, and if someone would see if anyone needs those, that would be just fine. And also, along the way, maybe talk a little bit about some aspects of the gospel, which are currently occupying my heart and my mind as I try and learn more about the purpose of the Lord Jesus. It isn't immediately clear, looking at the green handout, that there is a series of connections between the front page and the back page. Most of the trends and challenges link up with most of the responses and needs. And as we go through, I'll just try and draw attention to that at least some of the time and make some suggested connections there. Because I started yesterday by saying that a trend is a cold and factual thing, whereas a challenge is something that we emotionally respond to, such as the challenge of the harassed and helpless that were in front of Jesus Christ. So if it is true that some of these are challenges for navigators, at least in some parts of the world, then we should have some responses to them. We should have some things that we want to pursue or learn or accomplish, some obedience that we want to follow for our Lord. The first one here, interdependent partnership. I can approach this from several facets, and I'd like to just try two or three of these. First of all, let me say that it could be linked with the challenge of tribalism. If it is true that the state of the world is tribalistic, that patriotism has gone to seed, that I only like people like myself and you only like people like yourself, then a biblical solution that we need to model as a mission is interdependence and partnership. We need to show that we can walk with Romanian and Ghanaian and Dutch brothers and sisters, hand in hand, pursuing the same vision and the same values. To do this, we have had to learn to love diversity. This has proved very painful, I think, for many of us navigators. I have the privilege of attending most of our annual international leadership meetings for the last few years. I also have the semi-privilege of having to take the minutes. And it means at least that I can put my spin on the proceedings. But I have noticed a very interesting series of words over the last 5 or 6 years when we have talked in these meetings about diversity. Let me give you this series, and these are taken from the notes of about 5 years of meetings moving towards the present. Talking about diversity. Tolerate. Accept. We thought we were doing well then. We accept diversity. The next year, we were talking about affirming it. 4 years ago, we were talking about appreciating it. And 2 years ago, for the first time, we were talking about celebrating it. You see, tolerate, accept, affirm, appreciate, celebrate. It doesn't all come in year one. There are some things that I can intellectually embrace that I cannot yet emotionally put my arms around. We are learning to celebrate diversity. And it's hard. It's hard to be part of an agency that has 42 nationalities. They don't think like we think. They don't speak like we speak. They do the craziest things from time to time. And in our ethnocentrism, we judge them. So we have to learn to be an interdependent partnership. And one of the things that makes the partnership precious, one of the reasons why we're pursuing this as navigators, is because every one of us around the world, every one of our nationalities, has something to contribute to the whole. 5 years ago, I was instrumental in launching some meetings which we called resource exchanges. The idea was that we and the sending countries would go to Africa or the Middle East and meet the people in the receiving countries, and we would talk about what they needed and what we could provide. But we slipped in there right at the beginning deliberately that this was a resource exchange. And I remember our leader, Benjamin, in Romania, saying to me one day, before the revolution over there, I was in his home, he said, "I like the Global Society, Donald." I said, "Why?" He said, "Because it means that you are really focusing on helping us, that Americans and Europeans and so on are going to help us." I said, "That's not the main reason for the Global Society. The main reason is that you are also going to help us. We need you more than you need us. We need Romanians," and I told him this, "because of your faith, your courage, your endurance, the community that you have demonstrated over 40 years of oppression, your depth in the scriptures, your stories of sacrifice. We need this elsewhere. We in the West tend to be rather fat and rather flabby, and we need Romanian stories." So that's the reason why we want to be partners. That's the reason why we call ourselves a global society. And that's the reason this morning why my heart is very full of joy, because as some of you may know, we've just had the privilege of dedicating a set of abstract sculptures over there on the way to Bighorn. And these sculptures are a gift from my Romanian friend Liviu Mocan to the navigators, his way of saying thank you for the fact that we came from America years ago and we discipled him and his family. And so he's come back here, he's had a study year, he's almost finished, and this morning he could stand before about 50 of us and he could say, "I want to thank you, America, and I want to give you this sculpture to be on Glenery." And the sculpture expresses the gift of the Lord Jesus Christ for a hurting humanity. It's a very beautiful thing. It needs a little interpretation. If you're interested in it, I have brochures that we've written on it. Go and have a look at it before the end of the week. So, interdependent partnership. Let me go down another avenue on this matter of partnership. Partnership, I believe, is now running more freely across denominational and theological boundaries. Psalm 119, verse 63. "I am a friend to all who fear you, to all who follow your precepts." I am a friend to all who fear and follow Jesus Christ. I was in Singapore in 1989 at the Global Congress on Worldwide Evangelization, pompous title. The general concept was that at least some of us believed that it might be possible to significantly advance the cause of Christ before AD 2000. And on the platform on the final evening, there was Bill O'Brien of the Southern Baptists and a Roman Catholic bishop from the Philippines. And they both spoke of their love of Jesus, and they both spoke of what they hoped to do in serving him in the cause of world evangelization. And then they embraced one another publicly. Now, Southern Baptists and Roman Catholics embracing on platforms was very unusual, even 5 to 10 years ago. Almost risky, one might say. But it's a beautiful thing, and I'm sure Jesus was pleased. It reminds me of Jim Peterson's comment a couple of years ago. He said, "I will work at getting out the gospel with anyone who understands grace by faith." Anyone who understands grace by faith. For a number of years, I used to participate in annual conferences put on by a group called the Sword of the Spirit. They are a charismatic, Catholic, disciple-making, covenantal community. But that isn't the fun thing about them. They're out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, and they're very special people. And I was in one of their homes, and I noticed a number of people living in the basement. And I said, "Tell me about that." And he said, "Oh, that's the concept of a navigator home. Do you still do that?" And I said, "Where did you get this concept from?" "Well," he said, "you know, we've been exposed to navigators, and that's where we got our disciple-making emphasis from. We have people living in our homes." And then I was at dinner table. They, at dinner table, they took off, took from the shelf a book and opened it, and they read one chapter of this book together and discussed it. The book was Jerry Bridges, The Pursuit of Holiness. Catholic, charismatic, disciple-making community, the sword of the Spirit. This is a wonderful world, and I think Jesus is pleased. Interdependent partnership. Holding one another's hands up. For me, as an administrator, not everything I do appears to be directly, tangibly, and immediately linked to the Great Commission. I take a lot of comfort from Exodus 17, the story of Aaron and Hur holding up the hands of Moses while Joshua was down in the valley fighting the Amalekites. Partnership. A partnership that, as I said on Tuesday, is based on vision and values and relationships. In one sense, you could say that years ago, some of us were more concerned about hierarchy and control and performance review. I don't judge anyone other than myself. I grew up that way. I was very strong on MBO and the Navigators. I collected numbers and numbers and numbers. And I did some interesting things with those numbers and judged people. I judged people in other countries whom I never even met because of their performance, according to my numbers or lack of it. It was not good. I don't think the Lord was pleased. Now, vision, values, and relationships is what should drive us. Interdependent partnership. Then the matter of vulnerability. This is the second of these responses and needs. Vulnerability is a little hard to link to any of the challenges, but in one sense it could be linked to number three, the idea of a multipolar world, because much of what makes us vulnerable nowadays is that, as I was saying yesterday, your friends keep changing. You know, you have a certain group of people who agree with you on abortion, a certain group of people who agree with you on pornography, a certain group of people who agree with you on something else. The ancient certainties are somewhat dissolving. And in a missiological sense, vulnerability to me is a very important issue. And I would just like to test some things by making a couple of suggestions here. I feel that the mission of Jesus Christ in the New Testament is a mission of vulnerability. The vulnerability of the dusty streets of Nazareth, which I talked about on Monday. The vulnerability of the approach to Jerusalem and the opposition and the vulnerability of his very death. The kenosis, the emptying of himself, the whole concept that is expressed in Philippians 2. Now my question is, what does this mean to us as missionaries? If it is true, as I said on Monday, that Jesus is our model and our mentor in missions, what does it mean to be a vulnerable missionary? And this, I think, is sometimes an acute issue for us living in the USA. Even though we may not feel like it when we look at our salary check, we are significantly wealthier than most of the world. We have significantly more gadgets. We have significantly more access to travel and computers and commentaries and all the other things that God has showered upon us as a culture. What does it mean to regain our vulnerability? I think the Orthodox Church has something to teach us at this point. The Orthodox, partly because of their doctrine and understanding of the Holy Spirit, believe that when you enter a new place, that you go to receive a ministry from the Spirit of God. You don't take it to that place and drop it on them. You go to find out what God is already doing there because His Spirit is everywhere. And you receive a ministry. The very antithesis of the triumphalism that has sometimes stained, thank you, our Western ways of doing mission. So we have to think as missionaries here in this country and overseas, what does it mean to be missionaries in a context where we have had tremendous power and where we have lots of things which other nations want? Let me use the illustration of Albania again. I mentioned that probably 50% of the young Albanians who come forward to the gospel appeal in the football stadium in Tirana come, very understandably, because they need a few dollars, because they're desperate to get to Italy, because they have no food in their homes. They are coming to us for things which we have, material things. How do we distinguish that and offer them enough vulnerability that we are not always carrying with us so many goodies that we even obscure Jesus Christ himself? Because people see the goodies, they don't see Jesus. This is a special issue for us in the West. This is a special issue for navigators. It may not be an issue much longer, because in my personal opinion, as a non-economist, the affluence of the USA is largely sustained by mirrors. It feels good, but it won't last long. So we may not have this issue by the end of the decade, but at the moment we still do. Relative to the rest of the world, we are absolutely stacked with goodies. And we want to hold up Jesus Christ and not have people notice the Christmas tree full of goodies. One of the best studies by a navigator in this area is a paper by the Canadian navigator Al Bassett. It is called The Dilemma of Western Energy. That title in itself says a little bit. Our energy is a good thing. Our energy is also a danger. It sometimes makes us offer the solution when we haven't listened to the problem. So there's a good thing and a bad thing about Western energy. And I have been listening to Darrell and over there and to Terry Taylor and others and noticing how, as they have done their planning for the commission, they are thinking clearly and well and more about how do you have a massive campaign in a country such as Russia and yet behave as gospel carriers rather than as steamrollers? It's not an easy thing, and the people who are leading the commission need prayer for this, that they would, in fact, offer gospel and nothing but the gospel. So this is some reflections on the matter of vulnerability. We are a community of servants. Now, again, in the third area here, the word and deed, you could link this, if you wanted to, as a response to the fifth general challenge, the challenge of economic stress. The concept of a gospel of word and deed has always been there in the scriptures, but for me, at least, the blinkers have been taken off only recently when I began to think more about what gospel means in the hard places of the world. What do you do in Ethiopia or the Sudan? And I've begun to discover something which I'm sure you've known for years, but has been new for me. I see the gospel now as like an onion. You keep peeling it, and there's even more. And the aroma is still strong. I like the smell of onions, by the way. The aroma is still strong, and yet there's more and more and more there than one ever realizes. When I became a believer 30 years ago, if you asked me what has happened, I'd say I have eternal life. In the words of my friend Ken, who was the first person I had the privilege of leading to Christ, he used to sing, play the guitar. He said, "Heaven is the haven that I'm going to." That was my concept of Christianity. I had my ticket now for heaven. I was going there, and it was good. And that's biblical, and that's right. But what does the gospel offer today? Next weekend, when you go home, is the good news for next week, as well as good news in heaven? And more I see, yes, there is inexhaustible good news. The benefits of wholeness. The gospel brings mercy. The gospel brings justice. The gospel brings healing. The gospel brings integration. Integration at the moment is very important for me as a facet of the gospel. The gospel integrates because it integrates our racial diversity in these days of rampant tribalism, and it enables us to come to the foot of the cross and to hold hands together. It integrates our economic life. I don't have to live any longer as an accumulation machine, just collecting, just absorbing new goodies. Whether slave or free, I receive a new impetus to live as part of a community and an impetus to sacrifice for them. And the gospel integrates also our warring sexuality. It helps me understand how to relate well to women, and they to us. We need that. We need it very much. By ourselves, we are not complete. The gospel integrates, and there are aspects of the gospel like this which are profoundly important for the lay people among whom we are working. Profoundly important. Integration does not mean averaging. It does not mean destroying our differences. It means that we can be part of the synthesis. I have a dear navigator friend who lives in Chicago, and he rather poignantly said to me about a month ago, he said, "Donald, I really want to be part of the synthesis, not the antithesis." Somehow he feels that he's always has to make a point or he has to stand against something, and it tires his soul. He wants to be part of the synthesis, and we all do. The gospel offers synthesis. And one more point on this, it is because of the integration of the gospel that these careful distinctions that we read in the literature of the last 20 years, the evangelical literature, these careful, precise, nuanced distinctions between evangelism and social action, between presence and proclamation, I think that these things slice up the gospel, because the good news is Jesus, full of grace and truth. And he is active on both sides of the evangelism and social action fence. He is active whenever we let ourselves be channels of his love. So to some extent, these careful debates on the nature of the gospel, I feel, are not giving the energy that the gospel truly carries and has for us and for those whom we're trying to reach. I'd like to make a quotation from Peter Kuzmich. He is a Yugoslavian Baptist. I listened to him at Lausanne 2 in Manila a few years ago, and he was speaking about the gospel and about us. He said, quote, "The problem today is not that we lack a credible message, but rather that we so often lack credible messengers. We lack those whose lives are irrefutably in harmony with the gospel and who can carry it with authenticity and power." And I wrote that in a page on the back of my Bible. I would like to be someone who carries the gospel with authenticity and power, because my life, as well as my words, is in harmony with the Lord Jesus Christ. Word and deed. So there is a fuller gospel than some of us have understood. A gospel that not only saves us, but rehumanizes us and eventually will reconstitute all things. Colossians 1:15 to 20, Colossians 2, Ephesians 3:8 to 11, and so on. Perhaps one more thing on the gospel, because today I had originally planned to speak mainly on the gospel of transformation, so let me just say one other thing here. Missionaries. Missions is our title this week. The first human missionary, of course, was Abraham, the father of missions. I like Abraham very much because he kept making mistakes. It's kind of encouraging. Genesis chapter 12, he got his briefing, his marching orders from God, and by halfway through chapter 12, he was down in Egypt telling lies about his wife. Didn't go so well. But in between the sevenfold command of Genesis 12, 1 to 3, and the failure in Egypt, Abraham, as he moved along, did two things, and two things only, if you were to study Genesis 12. The two things that we are told about are, first, that he built altars. He built altars as he went along in two or three places in that chapter. And altars are a symbol, I believe, of holiness, of purity. He wanted to express back to God purity. The theme of Galatians, he wanted a pure gospel. He had just been commissioned as the first missionary, the carrier of the good news about God, and he built altars. And then secondly, he pitched tents. He set up his tent in several places before he got to Egypt. And that, of course, is a symbol of mobility. And this brings us right back to the phrase that you've often, I think, heard Jim Peterson write about or talk about. We want a gospel that has purity and a gospel that has mobility. It's fascinating to me that in Genesis 12 there, we see both these concepts and nothing else as soon as the command has been given to be a blessing to the nations. The purity and mobility of the gospel, the building of altars, and the pitching of tents. Culture can be a barrier or a carrier to the gospel. Abraham was a carrier of the purity and mobility of the gospel.
Do you have a question, opportunity later on, or can you just ask questions now?
Oh, please.
You brought up back earlier that pluralism is one of the dilemmas of the day of culture, perhaps primarily Western, but perhaps you
yes.
from that.
Yes.
How then is there this purity of the gospel and this distinctiveness that separates? And how then do we adapt in a world that's plural and still be distinct? How do you see us as navigators mm-hmm. have a pure gospel mm-hmm. and still integrate the pureness of that in a world that's so
yeah. That's an outstanding question. How do we still keep hold of the purity of the gospel and yet reach and get close to people who are not only pluralistic, but whose lives are often a mess, right? Like ours. Well, something of that at the deepest level, I believe, lies in what I was trying to express on Monday. What we have to do is identify with people. We have to get close to them, close enough for them to experience us, close enough to serve them, close enough for them to know not just our words, but our hearts. And at the same time, through the protection of the scriptures that we know, through the infilling of the Holy Spirit, whom we love, and through the fact that we keep our eyes on Jesus, to trust God to allow us to move in these areas of uncleanness and not be brought down by them ourselves. Jesus went to be among prostitutes and sinners. We have to prepare ourselves to actually move in areas where there is tremendous difficulty, there are tremendous opposition to the gospel, and yet we have to hold on to Christ. I'm not sure if that exactly speaks to what you're asking, does it?
It doesn't. I'll give you some more time later on.
Okay. I'm sorry that I didn't catch it. Let's talk later. number four, lay ownership. Response number four. This might have something to do with the first trend and challenge that I mentioned, the one on people power. The idea of lay ownership is something which we as American navigators have spoken much about. We care about the laity. We want to create movements among the laity. And I can't speak very much about the experience that you've had here in the USA, but I do know my own heart, and I have seen in other countries some things which are still a warning. I think some of us think that to get the laity to participate with us is enough, is success, is good. And it is good. But participation is not enough. What we have to do is to go beyond helping other people participate in our ministry, and we have to empower them for their ministry and then just let go, just relinquish that, just rejoice in that, just celebrate it. Now, we think we know this, but if we follow one another around, my observation would be that very often it isn't quite like that. We are still eager for spontaneous movements which we would like to guide. And that's very human. Very human indeed. A Kenyan by the name of Dominic Musaru said once, paternalism is a very bad disease. It turns adults into children. I think that's a profound statement. Paternalism is a very bad disease. It turns adults into children. We cannot afford to take people who are beginning to mature as spiritual adults and reprocess them into the childhood phase, merely because we have some gifts of leadership, or we have a stronger vision, or we have more excitement about what we want to do, or we just are mobilizers, like my friend Paul Stanley. Paul is fascinating. He just keeps mobilizing people. And he and I talk a lot about this. And he tries and, you know, he tries to energize me a bit more, and I try to calm him down. We need one another. So we have to be very careful about practicing what we preach. And of course, I believe that the SRM project is really vital here, because the SRM has much to say to us about the nature of ministry and how we are the equippers, Ephesians 4, of others for ministry. So this is something. This is the fourth response, or the fourth need, if you like, that we navigators have, I believe, in the 1990s. And it's a subtle one, because we think we're doing it already. There was a meeting I attended on how to involve laymen in missions here at Glen Eyrie, I suppose about 6 months ago. And I observed at the coffee break that all seven of us were staff. So we're sitting around discussing how to involve laymen in missions. It's not so good that there weren't any laymen present. It's a little bit suspect. We need to be careful. And we need to be careful theologically. My friend Al Buzzard, the Canadian who wrote the paper on the dilemma of Western energy, he says that we export from this country and from Britain colorful versions of Western theology. You know, they have a little bit about animism and the spirit world, and a little bit about spiritual warfare, sort of in the appendix. They're dressed up a bit to fit in Africa, but they won't really fit. And this is deeply important to us as navigators. It doesn't really matter if we're just holding evangelistic crusades, because you can lead people to Christ with a colorful version of a U.S. theology, right? It's still Christ, and he will shine through. But what is our thing? What is our speciality? It's the second and third and fourth generation. And if you start with a gospel that is slightly impure, slightly immobile, and rather Western, you're not going to make it past the second generation, because it is not in the bloodstream of the people. Very, very important that we declutter our gospels so that people will experience the freedom of the flow for several generations. That's what navigators need to do. It doesn't matter very much if you're a seminary professor or a crusade evangelist, but it matters deeply for us. We must have it pure, because we've got to keep transmitting. One of the things that we want to do in the next couple of years in this area relating to lay ownership is something which I would nickname the Real Issues Project. The SRM has been an eye-opener for us. It has taught us, who have been used as some of the coordinators for it around the world, so much about the dynamics of adult interaction, as well as about the scriptures. One thing we feel very much is still lacking in the navigators is that we have to help our people come to grips with the issues that are special and vital in their part of the world. Let me give you an example. Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe, we are doing what I've referred to several times, and I'm not down on the West, I'm really not. I'm part of the problem. But we are tending to do in Eastern Europe a curriculum that brings in solutions to our problems, but does not have on the front burner solutions to their problems. For example, it was a tremendous need throughout Central Europe for a proper theology of work. Those of you who have served in that part of the world know that. The communists for 40 years guaranteed employment. Nobody could be unemployed. Nobody could ever be fired. And so Milan and our friends in Czechoslovakia are going around teaching executives in nationalized industries in Czechoslovakia about how to think biblically about work. And it isn't that airy-fairy. One of the first questions they got from the leader of one of the state organizations in Slovakia was, tomorrow, could you give us a one-hour seminar on how to fire people? Do Christians do things like fire people? Is that rather too abrupt? This man who leads probably 5,000 people organization, he said, I've never fired anyone in my life. I haven't the slightest idea how to do it, and I'm a Christian, and that makes it doubly uncomfortable. How do you fire people? You see, that's not a problem to us here. Those of us who've worked in... Well, it may be a problem to us. Okay. in principle, as the French say, it's not a problem to us. But it is a problem in Czechoslovakia. They need help with a theology of work. And they need to know a lot about how to handle corruption and bribery. So the real issues project is that several of us will go as servants into a culture like the culture of Czechoslovakia, and we will offer the opportunity to help them work through the Bible and their issues. And this is very important, I believe, for the sustaining of the second and third generations in those countries, like I was saying just now in another context. So we care about lay ownership. We want more than participation. We want people to get a hold of the scriptures and solve real issues. That's how you empower people, and that's how you can let go with peace and joy. Then the matter number five of renewed vision. And I would like to just put in the word missionary here also, renewed missionary vision. This is one of the things that I pray for the commission, that it would be a channel for reigniting the mission's vision of us, the American navigators. We need that. If the commission doesn't do it, something else needs to do it. On the handout that I gave us on Tuesday, I showed this plateau in the number of staff missionaries. Of course, more and more now we need lay missionaries. I recognize that. But there is a need for cross-cultural missions. And we have to go back to the roots that we grew up in, the roots of thinking about the world, of developing in our people a vision for the world, a commitment to the world, an excitement for the world. And this will have to be based on intimacy, as I put here, with a sovereign God. If it's based on the latest pep talk, or if it's based on some book you read or some preacher, it will not last when you go to places like Nepal and Cambodia. It will get very thin very quickly. Intimacy with God will lead to obedience to God. And this is what I'm thinking about when I speak of our need for a renewed vision. Now you may say to me, Donald, you're raining where it's already wet. This is not something that is a problem to me. Well, my point is that is it being transmitted to the people with whom you work? Is it being transmitted to the churches whom you counsel, to the pastors whom you interface with, to the people who are taught the 2-7? How much of there is there about a missionary vision in the 2-7? Is it a major plank in the 2-7? Should it be? Why or why not? The nations wait for us, and we have the privilege at this stage in history as Americans and semi-Americans of reaching out into the nations. I get so confused about what I am. Okay. I like to say us, and it doesn't feel right. Okay. Then the matter number six of frontiers and the unreached. And this is a response, not only, of course, to the leading of God, but also to the challenge number four, demographics. Because as I think you know, so much of the explosion in population is taking place in the developing world and is taking place in the non-Christian parts of the developing world. There are 340 approximately cities of over 1 million people in the world. About 60 of them are in China and about 40 of them are in India. The megacities, the burgeoning nests of humanity, are often in the most awkward places for the current distribution of the Christian gospel. I made a study some time ago of the Islamic megacities, people like places like Tehran and Cairo, and Islamabad. These cities are tremendously needy, and we have to find a new generation of missionaries who can work in places like this. And they're going to have to be bivocational people. No longer can we do what we did 20 years ago, and that was to gravely advise people to sell the farm. We want people who are qualified in professional terms and people who can operate on the frontiers. Now, you saw a few days ago, and you saw in the handout, that from a superficial glance, we're doing rather well. Did you look at the page, any of you, about the number of surveys? Did you notice that in 1990 we did surveys into a dozen new countries, and this year, if Donald is right, we're going into something like 18 or 19 new countries with surveys? You know, that's good. There is something happening in the navigators which was not happening 5 years ago. There was a lull in the mid-80s, a little bit of internal preoccupation around the world, some hesitation. That had to do partly with the change from a delegated organization where power comes down from the top to a society in which power comes up from the grassroots. And that caused us to sort of strip our gears a bit in terms of missions. Now we're through that, and now we see all these surveys, dozen different nationalities making them. But we have to get beyond surveys. We have to get beyond presence. We have to get beyond putting one couple in Mongolia and saying, we're in Mongolia, like I was doing on Tuesday. That's a very slim basis on which to claim a whole country. We have to be careful about these geographical lists that I produce. And sometimes I don't get a chance to say that, so I'm glad the Lord prompted me now. What we want is fruit in the mainstreams, not just presence of someone learning language in the capital. Frontiers and the unreached. We're still only filling about a third of the requests that are sent to us for staff missionaries. It's been like that since Jack was the U.S. director. I don't know if it's the Lord of the Medes and Persians, but forever and forever we fill about a third of the requests that our own people ask us to send. And I don't think there's anything magical about that number, and I'd like to see the trend broken. So we need to encourage our brothers and sisters to get out there into the nations. A commercial. Did I mention this earlier in the week? I may have done. If so, forgive me. Bob Boardman, you know Bordy, many of you, one of our missionary statesmen, he's now shepherding the young Canadian couple in Mongolia. And Bob Boardman is looking for a couple, American couple probably, in their late 30s, early 40s, mature people who could go and take 2-3 year terms in Mongolia and could really get that little navigator ministry moving strongly. And whoever did this, maybe someone you know, would have the privilege of being mentored by Bordy, and the excitement of being in a country that only has 200 Christians, and the delight of working with my friends Glenn and Ruth. This is a real need. Commercial number two, and then I'll stop. Commercial number two has to do with the fact that I am about to lose my secretary, and I want you to know that the International Office is a missionary outpost. It is a place to which Americans can be sent. And it would be just wonderful. That counts as a missionary. Anyone who sends a secretary to me will show up on the chart as another American missionary. So, you don't have to go to Mongolia. Just send a young lady to Colorado Springs, and I can have someone to co-labor with, which would be just wonderful. Steve.
So, you mentioned only going a third of the request.
Yes.
Is there something in the U.S. keeping us from, it seems like we have a lot of people, for sending more.
Well, I think there were big reasons and small reasons. One reason, of course... Oh, sorry, thank you. What is it, Steve says, that is hindering us navigators from sending more than a third of our people overseas? We have occasionally, in certain parts of the world, including for a couple of years in America in the early 70s, sent 50% of our people overseas. And that, as Jack well knows, overheated the system. We, in our frenzy, sent over some people who perhaps weren't fitted cross-culturally or who struggled. And so when you get significantly above a third, then there is this danger of just overheating the system. Our particular way of doing ministry depends on a strong home base. You cannot rape the USA of people in order to just send them all overseas. Our mission is not structured like that. But to balance that, we know far, far more than we did 20 years ago about what it takes to be a cross-cultural missionary. And people like Marvin Smith and others have developed simple and complex tests where we can find out, you and I can find out, are we suited? Are we likely to receive God's blessing if we go overseas? So I would say we're in a better position, technically, to send missionaries than we were. I feel that there has been a period, as I say, where we have not held up world vision before ourselves and our people. And I think that is returning. I believe it's returning, else Rich would not have perhaps had me here for 5 days. I hope it's returning. I believe it's returning. So there are small factors and there are large factors. And I think perhaps not so much whether it's a third or just over a third or just under a third, but just all of us need to be thinking missions in our daily and weekly prayer and planning and the way we go about our business. This is not a competition. No one even has the numbers now or has the heart to be counting to see whether California produces more missionaries than Texas. All that stuff has faded away, and beautiful that is. Now we just want to walk with God, and where God calls us to do something, we want to be obedient. If he doesn't call us, that also is fine.
Donald, in this renewed vision you have down here with SRM, how do you feel as a leader that 60%+ of this entity hasn't gone through the SRM? Would you speak to that?
How do I feel that some of us haven't gone through the SRM? Oh, very simple. I feel that you've missed a treat. It is a wonderful experience. This is not a promotional. This is not one of the commercials. I only gave you two commercials. I've been through the SRM. I had the privilege of writing some of the essays that looked into things and working closely with Peterson at the beginning of it for a while. And I tell you, the SRM has enlarged and expanded and stretched me like crazy. And that is very pleasing to me, because what I fear more than anything is that at the age of 55, I just clam up and stop learning. That's a horrible state for a disciple to be in. And so the SRM has been a safety thing for me that's kept me going and kept me thinking and kept me learning. I love it and I love teaching it, and it's good. Yeah.
How soon do you need a
secretary,
and does she have to raise her own support?
Oh, interesting. I'll have to make peace with Rich Cleveland later. How soon do I need a secretary, and does she need her own support? We would like her to raise as much as she could of her own support, but we understand that most young single women, or old single women for that matter, find that rather difficult, and we will come in and help her rather aggressively and vigorously, so she doesn't have to have anything like 100%. My existing friend Debbie Owinio has about $600 or $700 a month, and probably her budget is about $1,600 a month. Debbie plans to leave and go back to Kenya, a wonderful multicultural marriage, an American woman, a Kenyan man. It's going so well. She hopes to go and live in Kenya with him by next April. I'll miss her. Okay. Frontiers and the Unreached and the SRM and the Ardent Pursuit of the Nations. And of course, that's where our access program fits in. And then I think, in view of the time and in view of my own inadequacy, I don't want to say much about spiritual warfare, but I think you're going to agree with me when I say that, particularly here in the USA, this is what is popularly known as a hot topic. Right? Yeah? Spiritual warfare, territorial spirits, the unseen world, all these things, demons. I'm reading in this area. I'm trying to take part in some spiritual exercises that we have done, for example, here on Glen Eyrie, and cleansing this place and rededicating it for God. There have been demons in this place, and they have had to be expelled. And we have some significant intrusions into our property. But more than this property, we're talking about a trend of unusually visible activity by Satan in America. I think he's been here all along, but he's just for some reason becoming more visible, more assertive, and more tiresome. And we have to be prepared. This page is headed Responses and Needs. We have a need to be prepared to withstand the enemy, and we have to be able to unleash the power of Jesus Christ. One of the things we are doing very simply, planning to do internationally, is to try and overcome the boundaries that often grow up in an organization like ours. I don't know how it is in America, but I imagine you have an esprit de corps, the CDM entity, then there's the community and the military. And whether you like it or not, there are boundaries, aren't there? There are differences, there are sort of sub-ethoses. You don't find people hopping from entity to entity on an annual basis. Boundaries grow up overseas too. And we are very concerned about Islam. And the problem, if you look at it, we were just discussing it this week. If you look at a map of the world, Bob Verdano has the Middle East, the heart of Islam. Doug Sparks and his people have Asia. And Gert Dunnenbohl, our new Russia director, has Soviet Central Asia. So you have Dunnenbohl and Sparks and Verdano and all the people who work with them thinking in separate boxes about Islam. And the learning curve is not good. And so we are going to try and stimulate. I haven't even told Gert and Doug and Bob this yet, but they may not like it. Then we won't do it because they own, I don't own. But if we can stimulate what I call an Islamic support force, we have several gifted people who have been working among Muslims on our staff who happen at this stage of their careers to be somewhat loose, somewhat in between in the stage of their ministry, like David Bock, who's living here for a year, like Nabil Jabour, who's thrown out of Egypt and has just taken his doctorate in Islamics. We'll bring these men together, let them ferment one another, and we have an Islamic task force, and we're going to understand more and more about a gospel that will crack that toughest of all areas. And I got onto Islamics here because when I read the words demonic oppression, I think of Islam. It is the strongest force that is binding the captives throughout those 1,000,000,000 Muslims that I talked about. Okay. Just remember, finally, there are two ways to go. I said on Tuesday morning at the beginning that when you hear me talk about we're doing this, we're in Mongolia, we just won, don't hear that as triumphalism. Don't hear that as delusions of grandeur. Because I remind myself again this morning that there are two cities in the Bible. The city of Genesis 11 and the city of Revelation 21. And you know what I'm talking about? The city of Genesis 11, the city of Babel. It was a city of works. We began to build a city with a tower right up to heaven. And we felt so good about ourselves. We were trying to reach heaven. We were trying to reach God. We were trying to be spiritual. But we were doing it. God destroyed that. That was not pleasing. What he much prefers is in Revelation 21, is that he will lower his own holy city. He will graciously lower it down towards us and give it to us freely. Babel is the city of works. even though it's trying to reach God. The New Jerusalem is the city of grace. Don't let us ever, in our zeal for missions and in our zeal to do things for God, usurp and build like Babel rather than receive like Jerusalem. As missionaries, we need to go to receive a ministry from a sovereign God and walk and just reflect a little of the glory of Jesus Christ and nothing of ourselves. Trends and challenges, responses and needs. Thanks very much.